This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. General David Petraeus appeared in uniform, resplendent with ribbons, four stars shining, to make his report to a joint meeting of the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee. In this hour, we'll have highlights from today's hearing. Petraeus and his civilian counterpart in Iraq, Ambassador Ryan Crocker, faced quite a crowd in the vicinity of 100 members of Congress on these two big committees. The two officials offered a generally optimistic view of the situation in Iraq, with Petraeus bringing a bundle of charts showing diminished violence, which he attributed to the increased numbers of American troops in Iraq, the surge. And Crocker suggesting that there are moments of political progress in Iraq which may be taken, he said, as seeds suggesting possibilities for the future. Both men emphasized that Iraq is still a long-term commitment for the United States. Petraeus had reportedly been prepared to talk about a drawdown of troops of at least a brigade, 3,000 to 5,000, but instead he talked about a drawdown on a longer timeline, perhaps 30,000 troops out by next summer, which he later acknowledged would not quite get the numbers of U.S. personnel down to pre-surge levels. The hearing began, as they always do, with statements from the two chairmen and the two ranking Republican members, so that's where we'll start also. As you might imagine, the Democrats were considerably more critical of the administration's Iraq policy and progress than the Republicans were. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Ike Skelton, Democrat of Missouri, began by saying this hearing takes place at a critical moment when the nation is divided on the speed with which the U.S. should turn over responsibility for Iraq to its own forces. And Skelton raised questions about how seriously the U.S. is weakened by the long commitment in Iraq. Wars stress armies, he said, and we should be sure this war is vital to our national security. Then Chairman Skelton talked about the troop surge in Iraq and if it has made progress in Iraq possible.
The surge is just the latest in a long line of operations. It frankly looks as if there had been tactical progress in the security area, but we should at this point temper any enthusiasm with the caveat that this is Iraq, and nothing has been easy there. One of the great ironies of this hearing today is that General Petraeus, who sits here before us, is almost certainly the right man for the job in Iraq. But he's the right person 3 years too late and 250,000 troops short. If we had your vision approach, General, early on, we might not have gotten to the point where our troops are caught in the midst of brutal sectarian fighting without an Iraqi government bridging the political divides that drive the violence. The surge was intended to provide breathing space. Breathing space for the Iraqis to bridge sectarian divides with real political compromises. But while our troops are holding back the opposing team and to let them make a touchdown, the Iraqis haven't even picked up the ball. The President's July report and the GAO report of a few days ago showed the lack of progress on individual benchmarks, and no one can make the case that the Iraqi government has made great strides. The witnesses must tell us why we should continue sending our young men and women to fight and die if the Iraqis won't make the tough sacrifices leading to reconciliation. What's the likelihood that things will change dramatically? And will there be political progress in the near term? Are we merely beating a dead horse?
Skelton told the two witnesses he hoped they might persuade the committees that there is hope for a turnaround in Iraq. Chairman Tom Lantos, Democrat of California, who heads the Foreign Affairs Committee, was next in this very unusual two-committee hearing. The two Democratic chairs are followed by the two ranking Republicans. Lantos was critical of the administration.
Our witnesses have been sent here this morning to restore credibility to a discredited policy. We and the American people already know that the situation in Iraq is grim, and the growing majority of this Congress and of the American people want our troops out. The administration's myopic policies in Iraq have created a fiasco. Is it any wonder that on the subject of Iraq, more and more Americans have little confidence in this administration? We cannot take any of this administration's assertions on Iraq at face value anymore. And no amount of charts or statistics will improve its credibility. This is not a knock on you, General Petraeus, or on you, Ambassador Crocker. But the fact remains, gentlemen, that the administration has sent you here today to convince the members of these two committees and the Congress that victory is at hand. With all due respect to you, I must say, I don't buy it.
The Republican ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee is Duncan Hunter of California, who is also a candidate for president. He offered a very positive view of progress toward national reconciliation in Iraq.
Now, in my estimation, the stand-up of the Iraqi military is the key to a stabilized Iraq. And that means those 131 battalions that we have trained and equipped. And for those who said that we could have kept Saddam Hussein's army in place and that was somehow a major blunder, I'm reminded that Saddam Hussein's army had 11,000 Sunni generals. Now, what are you going to do with an army with 11,000 Sunni generals? Literally, squads of generals, many of whom have made their careers beating up on a Shiite population, when that army is supposed to be the honest broker that brings reconciliation to the communities in Iraq. And you know something? If you look at the leadership of the Iraqi army now, as shaped by General Petraeus and his subordinates, you now see Shiites in leadership positions. You see Sunnis in leadership positions. You see Kurds in leadership positions. You see a military which is starting to emerge as a professional force.
The two leadoff Republicans both mentioned newspaper articles critical of the facts in the Petraeus report and a controversial full-page ad in this morning's New York Times from MoveOn.org suggesting that General Petraeus is cooking the books on successes in Iraq. We'll have more about that later. Ileana Ross-Leighton, a Republican of Florida, is the ranking member on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She spoke about the importance of the mission in Iraq.
Our military strategy and our presence in Iraq is critical to progress on the political front, which helps ensure long-term security goals. Iraq has taken significant steps toward building a representative government, but it does have a long way to go on this difficult road. Our own history reminds us of how truly difficult that road is, but also of how worthy is the goal. Yet rapid withdrawal from Iraq would transmit to the radical Islamist that America has little real commitment to this goal and its stated core beliefs for temporary short-term relief. There could be no greater confirmation of radical Islam's indictment of this decadent West and its great Satan, us, America, which in their view is weak and unreliable.
General David Petraeus began his statement by saying that his report is his own, that he wrote his own testimony, and that although he briefed up the chain of command, he was at some pains to emphasize that his report was not written at the White House, as has been widely reported. But after that little introduction, he got down to cases.
As a bottom line up front, the military objectives of the surge are in large measure being met. In recent months, in the face of tough enemies and the brutal summer heat of Iraq, coalition and Iraqi security forces have achieved progress in the security arena. Though the improvements have been uneven across Iraq, the overall number of security incidents in Iraq has declined in 8 of the past 12 weeks, with the number of incidents in the last 2 weeks at the lowest level seen since June 2006. One reason for the decline in incidents is that coalition and Iraqi forces have dealt significant blows to al-Qaeda Iraq. Though al-Qaeda and its affiliates in Iraq remain dangerous, we have taken away a number of their sanctuaries and gained the initiative in many areas. We have also disrupted Shia militia extremists, capturing the head and numerous other leaders of the Iranian-supported special groups, along with a senior Lebanese Hezbollah operative supporting Iran's activities in Iraq. Coalition and Iraqi operations have helped reduce ethno-sectarian violence as well, bringing down the number of ethno-sectarian deaths substantially in Baghdad and across Iraq since the height of the sectarian violence last December. The number of overall civilian deaths has also declined during this period, although the numbers in each area are still at troubling levels. Iraqi security forces have also continued to grow and to shoulder more of the load, albeit slowly and amid continuing concerns about the sectarian tendencies of some elements in their ranks. In general, however, Iraqi elements have been standing and fighting and sustaining tough losses, and they have taken the lead in operations in many areas. Additionally, in what may be the most significant development of the past 8 months, the tribal rejection of al-Qaeda that started in Anbar province and helped produce such significant change there has now spread to a number of other locations as well. Based on all this and on the further progress we believe we can achieve over the next few months, I believe that we will be able to reduce our forces to the pre-surge level of brigade combat teams by next summer without jeopardizing the security gains that we have fought so hard to achieve. Beyond that, while noting that the situation in Iraq remains complex, difficult, and sometimes downright frustrating, I also believe that it is possible to achieve our objectives in Iraq over time, although doing so will be neither quick nor easy.
We'll have more on General Petraeus' plans to draw down troops in Iraq and the numbers on which he bases his assessment of successes there. Also, some analysis of those numbers in a minute. Please stay with us. You're listening to a special report from NPR News on the view from Iraq presented to two congressional committees today by the U.S. Commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus, and by Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who's Petraeus' diplomatic counterpart there. I'm Linda Wertheimer. In addition to claiming success for the troop surge in Iraq, General Petraeus announced troop withdrawals beyond the single brigade, several thousand soldiers, which he says will come out this year, bringing out around 30,000 troops by next summer. The general said that does not mean he is anticipating an increasingly rapid withdrawal to begin at that point.
Force reductions will continue beyond the pre-surge levels of brigade combat teams that we will reach by mid-July 2008. However, in my professional judgment, it would be premature to make recommendations on the pace of such reductions at this time. In fact, our experience in Iraq has repeatedly shown that projecting too far into the future is not just difficult, it can be misleading and even hazardous. The events of the past 6 months underscore that point. When I testified in January, for example, no one would have dared to forecast that Anbar province would have been transformed the way it has in the past 6 months. Nor would anyone have predicted that volunteers in one-time al-Qaeda strongholds like Ghazaliyah in western Baghdad or in Adamiya in eastern Baghdad would seek to join the fight against al-Qaeda. Nor would we have anticipated that a Shia-led government would accept significant numbers of Sunni Arab volunteers into the ranks of the local police force in Abu Ghraib. Beyond that, on a less encouraging note, none of us earlier this year appreciated the extent of Iranian involvement in Iraq, something about which we and Iraq's leaders all now have greater concern. In view of this, I do not believe it is reasonable to have an adequate appreciation for the pace of further reductions and mission adjustments beyond the summer of 2008 until about mid-March of next year. We will, no later than that time, consider factors similar to those on which I base the current recommendations, having by then, of course, a better feel for the security situation, the improvements in the capabilities of our Iraqi counterparts, and the enemy situation. I will then, as I did in developing the recommendations I have explained here today, also take into consideration the demands on our nation's ground forces, although I believe that that consideration should once again inform, not drive, the recommendations I make.
The question about whether this war has depleted the U.S. Army, perhaps leaving the United States vulnerable, is one that several members raised with General Petraeus. General Petraeus also talked in his opening statement about the long-term commitment to Iraq and the difficulty of withdrawing safely.
In describing the recommendations I have made, I should note again that, like Ambassador Crocker, I believe Iraq's problems will require a long-term effort. There are no easy answers or quick solutions. And although we both believe this effort can succeed, it will take time. Our assessments underscore, in fact, the importance of recognizing that a premature drawdown of our forces would likely have devastating consequences. That assessment is supported by the findings of a 16 August Defense Intelligence Agency report on the implications of a rapid withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. Summarizing it in an unclassified fashion, it concludes that a rapid withdrawal would result in the further release of the strong centrifugal forces in Iraq and produce a number of dangerous results, including a high risk of disintegration of the Iraqi security forces, rapid deterioration of local security initiatives, al-Qaeda Iraq regaining lost ground and freedom of maneuver, a marked increase in violence and further ethno-sectarian displacement and refugee flows, alliances of convenience by Iraqi groups with internal and external forces to gain advantages over their rivals, an exacerbation of already challenging regional dynamics, especially with respect to Iran. Lieutenant General Odierno and I share this assessment and believe that the best way to secure our national interests and to avoid an unfavorable outcome in Iraq is to continue to focus our operations on securing the Iraqi people while targeting terrorist groups and militia extremists, and as quickly as conditions are met, transitioning security tasks to Iraqi elements.
Joining me here in the studio is NPR's foreign editor, Lauren Jenkins, to talk about his impression of the Petraeus testimony. Lauren, first of all, he seemed pretty optimistic today. He had all sorts of charts showing how violence is down and deaths are down and so forth. And it doesn't quite square with the general tenor of the debate that we've heard from the Democrats in the campaign. It's like they're coming from very different places.
Well, I think you're right on that, Linda. You know, it's I was struck by just how optimistic both he and Ambassador Ryan were about were about the whole picture, which is really doesn't jibe totally with what we hear from our correspondents on the ground, from all those people we visit. We get a very much more complex picture and much more negative picture. One shouldn't be surprised. The military has a long tradition of always putting a positive spin on all wars. I think that's the nature of a soldier. You're taught to everything can happen. Can be done. You're not taught to face defeat. You're taught to face victories and find ways to make victories. We saw this in Vietnam. The 5 o'clock briefings were full of statistics and charts that were laid out year after year after year. And I think we're seeing this to a certain extent here.
Members of Congress who alluded to just exactly that in Vietnam.
I think so, and it all has to do with the methodology of how you gather statistics. And we don't know right now exactly what that methodology is. There have been claims by some people who have observed these statistics as they leaked out, saying they're cherry-picking the statistics that prove their case. There's an equal way of looking at them and finding statistics that prove just the opposite case.
We're going to go ahead and listen to what Ambassador Crocker had to say, and then I want to talk with you more about the content of both of their statements. Ambassador Ryan Crocker offered a political version of the military report given by the general. Ambassador Crocker called his report a sober assessment.
I intend to demonstrate that it is possible for the United States to see its goals realized in Iraq, and that Iraqis are capable of tackling and addressing the problems confronting them today. A secure, stable, democratic Iraq at peace with its neighbors is, in my view, attainable. The cumulative trajectory of political, economic, and diplomatic developments in Iraq is upwards, although the slope of that line is not steep. This process will not be quick. It will be uneven, punctuated by setbacks as well as achievements, and it will require substantial U.S. resolve and commitment. There will be no single moment at which we can claim victory. Any turning point will likely only be recognized in retrospect. This is a sober assessment, but it should not be a disheartening one. I have found it helpful during my time in Iraq to reflect on our own history. At many points in our early years, our survival as a nation was questionable. Our efforts to build the institutions of government were not always successful in the first instance, and tough issues such as slavery, universal suffrage, civil rights, and states' rights were resolved only after acrimonious debate and sometimes violence. Iraq is experiencing a revolution, not just regime change.
Ambassador Crocker, as you heard, compared what is happening now in Iraq to the founding years of the American Republic. He suggested that establishing democracy here was not easy, but that it may be considerably harder in Iraq.
In many respects, the debates currently occurring in Iraq on de-Ba'athification reform and provincial powers are akin to those surrounding our civil rights movement or struggle over states' rights. With de-Ba'athification, Iraqis are struggling to come to terms with a vicious past. They are trying to balance fear that the Ba'ath Party would one day return to power with the recognition that many former members of the party are guilty of no crime and join the organization not to repress others, but for personal survival. With provincial powers, Iraqis are grappling with very serious questions about what the right balance between the center and the periphery is for Iraq. Some see the devolution of power to regions and provinces as being the best insurance against the rise of a future tyrannical figure in Baghdad. Others see Iraq, with its complex demographics, as in need of a strong central authority. In short, we should not be surprised or dismayed that Iraqis have not fully resolved such issues. Rather, we should ask whether the way in which they are approaching these issues gives us a sense of their seriousness and ultimate capability to resolve Iraq's fundamental problems. Is the collective national leadership of Iraq ready to prioritize Iraq over sectarian and community interests? Can and will they come to agreement about what sort of Iraq they want? I do believe that Iraq's leaders have the will to tackle the country's pressing problems, although it will take longer than we originally anticipated because of the environment and the gravity of the issues before them.
Ambassador Crocker had his own version of the numbers cited by General Petraeus, the progress he sees in this year, and his concerns about what a withdrawal from Iraq might mean.
As we look ahead, we must acknowledge that 2006 was a bad year in Iraq. The country came close to unraveling politically, economically, and in security terms. 2007 has brought some improvements. The changes to our strategy last January, the surge, have helped change the dynamics in Iraq for the better. Our increased presence made besieged communities feel that they could defeat al-Qaeda by working with us. Our population security measures have made it much harder for terrorists to conduct attacks. We have given Iraqis the time and space to reflect on what sort of country they want. Most Iraqis genuinely accept Iraq as a multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian society. It is the balance of power that is yet to be sorted out. Enormous challenges remain. Iraqis still struggle with fundamental questions about how to share power, accept their differences, and overcome their past. Whether Iraq reaches its potential is, of course, ultimately the product of Iraqi decisions. But the involvement and support of the United States will be hugely important in shaping a positive outcome. Our country has given a great deal in blood and treasure to stabilize the situation in Iraq and help Iraqis build institutions for a united, democratic country governed under the rule of law. Realizing this vision will take more time and patience on the part of the United States. I cannot guarantee success in Iraq. I do believe, as I have described, that it is attainable. I am certain that abandoning or drastically curtailing our efforts will bring failure, and the consequences of such a failure must be clearly understood by us all. An Iraq that falls into chaos or civil war will mean massive human suffering, well beyond what has already occurred within Iraq's borders. It could well invite the intervention of regional states, all of which see their future connected to Iraq's in some fundamental way. Undoubtedly, Iran would be a winner in this scenario, consolidating its influence over Iraqi resources and possibly territory. The Iranian president has already announced that Iran will fill any vacuum in Iraq. In such an environment, the gains made against al-Qaeda and other extremist groups could easily evaporate, and they could establish strongholds to be used as safe havens for regional and international operations. Our current course is hard. The alternatives are far worse.
Ambassador Ryan Crocker, reporting to the House Armed Services Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee this afternoon. Lauren Jenkins is still here with us in the studio. Lauren, were you surprised at the tone Ambassador Crocker took? It was, I think, a little less optimistic, perhaps, than the general, but still, he seems to feel that with patience and with a long application of effort, that the United States can help Iraq into whatever this new world is that they decide they want to go into. But what seems so striking to me is that this does not take into account the complete lack of patience in the United States.
Well, I think you're right, Linda. I mean, I was struck by this statement. Ryan Crocker, I've known since I was a young reporter in Beirut, and he was a political officer 25 years ago. He's a very smart, astute diplomat. He knows the Middle East. He speaks the language. He's your ideal ambassador in a situation like this. But this statement just totally seemed to be avoiding looking at the really complex issues that is Iraq. The issues of benchmarks, which was the main reason the surge was started, was last March.
Give them breathing room to get a government,
a central government that could pass 18 right. basic benchmarks that were needed for reconciliation and to find some sort of security and stability in Iraq. Of those, the GAO report that just came out last week said at most they had met three, minor three. They had perhaps advanced towards four, and the 11 key benchmarks weren't met at all. This is what the surge was supposed to produce. This was how we were going to measure the surge success or not success. The only mention in Ambassador Crocker's report was, he says, some of the more promising political developments at the national level are beyond or neither measured to be benchmarks or visible to those far from Baghdad. He avoids really talking about the whole south of the country, which the British are pulling out from, leaving an area which has 80% of the country's revenue and 30% of its population, which is now total anarchy with various Shiite groups fighting each other for power and money. and prestige and whatever. This is going to leave our troops vulnerable because that's also the main supply route from Kuwait up into the heart of Iraq where our troops are.
So and it has to be protected and cleared out somehow.
It has to, and this isn't even mentioned. Or as I say, the intra-Shiite fights that are as bitter as anything that's going on in terms of the insurgency.
There was a considerable amount of talk about Anbar province, the good news province in Iraq, apparently, and about former insurgents who have decided to come over to the side of the Americans. As the general put it, they've decided to stop pointing their guns at us and start pointing them at al-Qaeda in Iraq.
It's absolutely, you know, an amazing development that surprised everybody, at least everybody who hadn't read about old tribal politics in Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia learned that very early on during World War I, that tribes in that region follow the old adage that mine enemy's enemy is my friend. And I think they saw themselves threatened both by the Shia advances and al-Qaeda, and they've decided to use the Americans or join with the Americans to get rid of people in their midst that they don't want.
Next, we're going to hear from a few members of this extraordinarily large committee and their questions. That'll happen in about a minute. Stay with us. You're listening to a special report from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. As I mentioned earlier, today's hearings were not void of politics. Both ranking minority members and other Republicans as well talked about a MoveOn.org ad in today's New York Times, which asked, "General Petraeus or General Betrayus?" And then, a half a dozen times or so, the hearing was interrupted by anti-war protesters. Here's what that sounded like, and here's how Chairman Ike Skelton dealt with them at one point.
No. Please remove them. Let me make this announcement that those who have caused unlawful conduct and improper conduct, who have, who are, and who will throughout the remaining of this hearing will be prosecuted under Section 10-503-16 of the District of Columbia, and we will prosecute them under the law.
NPR's David Welna joins us from the Capitol. David, first of all, what is the Republican strategy of bringing up that MoveOn.org ad? And second, who were those protesters?
Well, Linda, Republican leaders read nationwide polls, and so they know how well-respected General Petraeus is among the general public. So I think their expressions of outrage today over the MoveOn.org ad and also their repeated demands that Democrats join them in repudiating that ad were all about portraying Democrats as being out of step with public sentiment on Petraeus and by extension on the war in Iraq, though polls seem to show otherwise. Now, Democrats do, in fact, have a pretty close association with MoveOn.org. They meet with the group's leaders regularly. And I didn't hear any of them today take the bait from Republicans and denounce Petraeus or General Betrayus, as the ad said. So when Florida Republican Ileana Ross-Lehtinen called on Democrats at the hearing with Petraeus and Crocker to use the hearing to distance themselves from the ad, New York Democrat Jerry Nadler objected, and he raised a point of order, in fact, saying that, as he put it, nobody has to distance themselves from something they weren't associated with. But some Democrats did say that Petraeus, in fact, was too close to the troop surge and to give any objective assessment of it. Now, as for who these
demonstrators,
people,
who they were.
Yeah, these were people who raised a ruckus at the hearing today, and they've been at many other Iraq-related hearings in the past. They're with a group that calls themselves Code Pink. They wear pink clothing to these hearings, and they normally silently hold up protest signs and don't go much further at hearings. But today, when some of them started shouting protests, that's when the Democratic chairman, Ike Skelton, essentially first called on the police to haul some of them out. And then when they persisted, he read them the Riot Act and had them arrested or warned that they were going to be arrested for unlawful conduct. And in fact, four of them were. One of the people who was booked today was Cindy Sheehan, whose son was slain in Iraq and who's become sort of a hero of the anti-war movement. But, you know, Democrats right. today, even if they essentially agreed with these protesters, seemed intent on keeping order. So out they went.
Thanks very much, David.
Sure, Linda.
NPR's David Wellner, who was in the room in the hearing today. The two committees had twice the difficulty they usually have trying to make time enough for each member to get to ask a question of witnesses who, in this case, had to leave by early evening. In these situations in Congress, of course, the senior members have the advantage, and that starts with the chairman, Ike Skelton, the Democrat of Missouri, who had the first question. He told Ambassador Crocker he was not optimistic about the progress made in Iraq, and none of the political benchmarks Congress hoped would be met have been met.
It appears, Mr. Ambassador, using your phrase, that the key pieces of legislation have not been passed by the Parliament, and it appears that to this country lawyer that the leaders and parliamentarians of Iraq have been sitting on their thumbs while the young men and women of America are doing their best to bring security. The surge was announced in January, began in February. Here it is, September. And since the surge was announced and began, the Iraqi leaders have made some progress in passing and implementing measures to bring about national reconciliation. Mr. Ambassador, why should we in Congress expect the next 6 months to be any different than it has been in the past?
Mr. Chairman, you are frustrated. The American people are frustrated. I am frustrated every day I spend in Iraq on the lack of progress on legislative initiatives. Iraqis themselves are frustrated. As I attempted to lay out in my statement, these are extremely complex legislative endeavors, and Iraqis are engaging on them with fundamental issues concerning the nature of the state as yet unresolved among them. So it is going to be difficult. It is going to take time. The efforts in the course of the summer that I mentioned, the statement of August 26th in which Iraq's key leaders committed themselves to continued engagement on these issues and announced agreement in principle on de-Ba'athification reform and provincial powers suggest to me that, first, they are serious. Second, they are capable of coming together and thrashing out serious issues in a deliberate and serious manner. That said, Mr. Chairman, I frankly do not expect that we are going to see rapid progress through these benchmarks. It is important to remind ourselves that the benchmarks are not an end to themselves. They are a means to national reconciliation. And I think it is very important that we maintain a sense of tactical flexibility and encourage the Iraqis to do the same, to seize opportunities to advance national reconciliation when they arise, as we have seen in Anbar and as we have seen in the government's response to Anbar. Through distributing additional budget resources to this province and bringing its young men into security forces. So while I would certainly share disappointment that progress has been slow on legislative benchmarks, that to my mind does not mean there has been no progress toward reconciliation. There has been. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I think it is important for all of us to remember that the surge hit its full stride just in the month of June. Sectarian violence is diminished, but it is not stopped. And I think it is going to take more time before the impact of improved security, which all of Iraq's leaders acknowledge has taken place, I think it will take more time before that impact is felt in such a manner that political compromise becomes easier.
Next, Tom Lantos of California, who is chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, wanted to know about reports that General Petraeus' view of the situation in Iraq is not shared by some of his military superiors.
I don't know how accurate these news reports are, but responsible media have suggested that even Admiral Fallon, among others, has favored a more rapid and more substantial withdrawal than what you are proposing. Now, without dealing in individuals, am I wrong in assuming that responsible military leaders, both active and retired, favor considerably more rapid withdrawals than you do, particularly in view of the fact that our global security requirements seem not to be part of the calculation that you properly are making, because you are commander for Iraq. You have no responsibility for Afghanistan or for any other contingency that might arise.
Admiral Fallon fully supports the recommendations that I have made, as do the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In fact, I also talked to the Chief of Staff of the Army most recently this morning. We had discussions about the pace of the mission transition, but there has been no recommendation I am aware of that would have laid out by any of those individuals a more rapid withdrawal.
Admiral Fallon is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. After the chairman and the ranking minority members asked their questions, other members of these committees got a chance, but not all of them. There were, after all, 100 or so of them in the room. Like the committee itself, we also don't have time this evening to hear from everyone, so we've picked a couple of committee members for you to hear. First, here's Congressman John McHugh. He's a Republican from New York.
Ambassador Crocker, you've said it. I think everyone on this panel feels that probably most, if not all, Americans feel a great deal of frustration toward the Iraqi government and the slowness in which they've taken steps that are commensurate with the military side of this equation. And I certainly share those. When folks talk about sending a message to the Iraqi government, there's very few things we can see in effect, such as military reductions, that we perceive as perhaps being helpful in turning the screws, encouraging them to make those hard decisions. Advise us, sir, what can we do effectively to send a message to facilitate positive steps by Maliki and the government that's currently in power?
It's a great question, and certainly it's one that General Petraeus and I wrestle with almost every day. First, on the issue of troop reductions as a lever, I think we have to be very careful about this. If the Iraqis develop the sense that we're prepared for a non-conditions-based withdrawal of substantial numbers of our troops, my view is that it would make them less inclined to compromise and not more. And the reason for that is that if they see us coming out, they're still going to be there. And they are then going to be looking over, increasingly over the tops of our heads, over the horizon, to figure out how they're going to survive and how they're going to get through the coming massive sectarian conflict. It's the kind of thing we've got to think very carefully about, and I'm extremely cautious in ever putting that out on the table. I find that what I kind of need to do on a day-to-day basis is first try to understand, and that's why I spent some time in my statement on how things got to be the way they are in Iraq. That doesn't mean saying, well, you're an abused child, so it's okay to do whatever you want, but it does help to understand why these things are difficult. with that understanding, then figuring out where some pressure works, what kinds of pressure, where encouragement works, where some fresh thinking works. And we employ all of that on a fairly regular basis. And one example of a small success was our encouragement for the Anbar Forum that took place just last Thursday that brought federal and provincial leaders together in Anbar.
I promoted Admiral Fallon. He is apparently head of CENTCOM, which is Central Command. He has charge of the whole Middle Eastern region and is one of General Petraeus' many bosses. Finally, we'll hear from Kathy Castor, a Florida Democrat, who quoted several recent reports on Iraq that were much more critical than General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker were today. And then she asked this.
I think the American people want to know, as we're in the fifth year of this war, how much longer, how many billions of dollars more, while we are growing a global strategic risk?
Congresswoman, if I could, one reason that I did recommend the reduction of forces is because of recognition of the strain on our ground forces. Again, that was an important operational strategic consideration that did inform the recommendations that I made. I might point out, by the way, that we could have literally run the surge all the way until April. That's the first time that a surge brigade hits 15 months. But because of a variety of considerations and also, frankly, the battlefield geometry of figuring out how to most efficiently and with minimal reliefs in place and so forth get to where we need to be by mid-July, we recommended the reduction of the brigade combat teams in addition to the Marine Expeditionary Unit that will come out later this month without replacement, but that the reduction of the brigade combat teams begin in mid-December. If I could also point out again that Iraqis are taking over considerable responsibility. The recent celebration of the death of the seventh Imam, which results in the convergence of about typically approaching a million pilgrims to an important shrine in north central Baghdad, the Qadamiyah Shrine, this year was planned and executed by Iraqi forces in a true interagency effort, overseen by the Baghdad Operational Center and its commander, but also involving not just army and police, but also emergency services, other transportation assets, medical assets, and so forth. 2 years ago, there were nearly 1,000 pilgrims who were stampeded to death when rumors of enemy action or perhaps actual activities resulted in that particular event. Every other year, there have been dozens of individuals killed by terrorist activities. This year, we are not aware of any deaths due to extremist activity, and the only deaths at all were from accidents, just normal accidents that took place on that day.
Lone Jenkins, let me bring you in again just to wrap up. We were expecting something like this today, the calls for continuing the surge for at least a while. How well do you think these two, General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker, did making their case?
I think they did very well. I think there were no surprises. This case has been started to be made months ago. There's been a bombardment of leaks and preparations of what the military calls preparing the battleground. Well, here they prepared the political battleground that they were going to face in Congress. And I think it was all laid out that the surge will continue. It's going to be, the statement is, there's no end in sight. It's going to take a long, long time, a great more commitment on the U.S. part, more sacrifice before this could ever be resolved, if it can be resolved.
But do you think they could? Do you think they sold it? I mean, the New York Times had printed a poll today that said that the American people were far more inclined to trust generals to end the military involvement in Iraq than to trust the president. Only 5% trust the president, and not very many more, about four times that trust the Congress.
I think that's true, and I think certainly the Congress is more willing to trust generals in a situation like this. I think they were very differential on both sides of the aisle. I would suspect when it comes to a vote, they will all vote to continue the surge.
Thanks very much, NPR's senior foreign editor, Lauren Jenkins. Our special report was produced and edited by Marcus Rosenbaum with considerable help from Evie Stone. Our director was Gwen Uten. Marty Curcius is our engineer. Thanks very much for joining us for this summary of the Petraeus Report presented to Congress today. We'll have more on General Petraeus's report tomorrow when he speaks to the United States Senate. I'm Linda Wertheimer, NPR News, Washington.